From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Consumer advocate, good government guru, and now presidential candidate, Ralph Nader.
There is increasing rigidity about what maximum employment is defined as. And I'm astonished, looking back at what we thought was full employment in the 60s, to see that a 5 to 6% or even higher rate of unemployment is now considered acceptable, which brings along with it a 20 to 25% rate of child poverty.
A conversation with the candidate, followed by a discussion with Green Party activists working to get Nader on the November ballot around the country. All coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In California, in Nevada, and in Washington State, a sweep for Bob Dole. Today, though, we're going to be talking to another candidate. He's on the California presidential ballot. Yesterday, he was on the Green Party line, and he is consumer activist Ralph Nader. We'll be speaking with him about his race in California and the attempts to get him on ballots around the country, what his platform is. That's all coming up, but right now we're going out to Larry Bensky, our Pacifica National Affairs correspondent, who's in our Pacifica station in Los Angeles today. He's at KPFK. Larry, can you do a wrap-up for us of the California primary?
Well, Amy, it would be very difficult. It'd probably take all hour because there were primary contests in many state assemblies, state senate, and congressional races. The top of the ticket, which was what we'll look at here, Bob Dole got an overwhelming victory, approximately 66%. Pat Buchanan taking around 18% of the vote. That, by the way, still translates into 500,000 Californians who voted for Pat Buchanan. What most of the nation was watching in California, if anything, other than the top-of-the-ticket presidential race, were three propositions that were on the ballot trying to limit attorneys' fees and instill no-fault insurance. Excuse me. These measures were opposed by Ralph Nader, and we'll talk to him about that in a moment, as well as the Consumer Federation of America and Consumers Union, and all three went down to defeat. Propositions 200, 201, and 202. The final one, which would have limited attorneys' contingency fees, went down to defeat very narrowly, 51% to 49%. The others lost overwhelmingly. What was interesting in the exit polls yesterday, Amy, was that the Republican voters who voted for Bob Dole, and we've seen this in other states that we've been covering on Pacifica as well, did it without a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. 51% of those Republicans exit polled said they wish there were another candidate in the race other than the ones they'd had to vote for. As far as all the voters were concerned, this was a very low turnout in California, around 40% of the eligible electorate. And when they were polled, exit polls again, as to who they would vote for in the fall among Clinton, Dole, and Perot, it came out 53% Clinton, 32% Dole, and 8% Perot. Ralph Nader wasn't asked there. So President Clinton's double-digit, indeed more than 20 percentage point lead over Bob Dole in California still holds in that particular poll. Only 41% of the Republicans thought that Dole could beat Clinton in November. So you have a small and relatively dispirited band of Republicans voting here in California yesterday. As far as the general electorate is concerned, they returned one more seat to the state Senate for the Democrats, which is important, of course, in this very large state. The Democrats hold only one of the two houses in Sacramento right now, state capital. And, of course, the governor is also a Republican.
Larry, as you sum up all of the mainstream happenings in California, we're going to be joined right now by consumer activist and now presidential candidate Ralph Nader. He's allowed his name to be placed on the Green Party primary ballots in California and Maine and New York. They are clamoring for him here. We welcome Ralph Nader to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. It's nice to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I guess we can't quite see you, though we do talk about seeing you on the radio. Why don't you tell us what your platform is and your reaction to the primary in California yesterday?
Well, the defeat of those propositions, 200, 201, 202, is a defeat of autocracy. It's a defeat of the destruction of legal protections that injured people and defrauded people. Now have to go into court and hold their wrongdoers accountable. The victory in California against these propositions came in spite of a $15 million inflow of dollars, largely from the Silicon Valley mega millionaires and to some degree from the insurance industry. It's important to note that this is a crucial battle. Had those propositions won, these instant billionaires in the computer industry would have tried to do the same thing in other states around the country. Just pour a lot of money in, get some slick, deceptive 30-second TV ads, and persuade legislatures or voters to destroy their own rights. So in a way, this was a showdown in California. And once again, the people of California came through and said, we know who's behind this. We don't want to have any part of it. As far as the platform here, in terms of the Green presidential effort, Amy, it is going to be a very focused one. This is not going to be a platform where there's a position on every issue of concern to various people and groups. I want to focus strictly on how we build democracy in this country. Democracy is a great problem-solving mechanism. And as people from President Andrew Jackson to John Dewey once said, if a society is in trouble that presumes to be a democracy, the solution is not less democracy, more democracy. And so we want to take the five roles that people play in a democracy. The lead political role, of course, is voter-citizen. And then the others are workers, consumers, taxpayers, and shareholders. And say, look, what are these people's assets and rights, and why are they so powerless? Why does big money nullify votes? Why are there so few states with initiative referendum recall? Texas doesn't have it. New York State doesn't have it. Why do consumers find themselves losing more and more of their negotiating and bargaining power and being forced to enter into contracts with HMOs and banks and insurance companies that force them to accept compulsory arbitration, stripping them of their rights to go to court and stripping them, therefore, of their bargaining power? Why is it that workers have such a hard time forming unions, especially in the private sector, where it's almost come to a halt? Isn't there a need for a change in the labor laws to bring them up to date, at least to the level that Canadian workers can avail themselves of in forming unions up there? And then why do so many Americans who, through their pension trusts as workers, own large chunks of major corporations but have no influence whatsoever over those corporations? That is, they own large portions of the corporation, and the banks and insurance companies who invest these pension trusts control the workers' money, $4 trillion worth, the biggest pool of capital probably in the history of the world. So all these five roles need the kind of facilities that fulfill three obvious functions: getting information to people in a timely fashion, allowing people to communicate without any advertising sensors or screens this information easily to one another, and thirdly, the facility to mobilize people for action. There's a good model in the consumer area in Illinois called the Illinois Citizen Utility Board, which developed in 1983 from a state law that required inserts in the electric, telephone, gas billing envelopes. And now these inserts go in the state government envelopes to the people of Illinois. And this insert invites people to join a consumer residential ratepayers group at the consumer's option. 200,000 people are now members of the Illinois Citizen Utility Board. It has a staff of economists, lawyers, organizers, communication specialists. It takes on the electric, telephone, gas companies before the regulatory agencies, legislature, and the courts. And in just one victory in September 1993, it secured a private agreement with Commonwealth Edison, you know, the big electric utility there, to refund $1.3 billion, with a B, dollars to Northern Illinois families. Now, it's that facility, that envelope, that technique, which could also operate on television, you know, for mass media, that completely changes the strength and fiber in a positive sense of our democracy.
Ralph Nader, I don't know if you can hear me or not. This is Larry Bensky in Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we go back for a moment to the California ballot that you were talking about a moment ago, the anti-consumer propositions you were talking about? You say that this was a great people's victory against the Silicon Valley millionaires, but of course, your side, the trial lawyers, the Consumer Federation, Consumers Union, had to spend an enormous amount of money to get this very narrow victory, something like $10, $12 million. The other side also spent $10, $12 million. And they say they're going to be right back again with similar propositions in the fall. We're in a kind of financial arms race here on ballot measures in California, which is completely out of control. You say you want to get initiative and referendum on in other states. Wouldn't this just kind of spread that plague of contagious dollars everywhere?
Well, the Silicon Valley mega millionaires spent $15 million or more. I think the other side spent about $10 million. But what was important is that the Silicon Valley people had an advantage in the primary. It's much easier to defeat these propositions when there's a larger turnout in California in the November election. So this was their peak. Now, they may be foolish enough to try to do it again, although I think that some of them are having second thoughts. But I never give up on the initiative form of government, just as I never give up on free speech. That's democracy. You're going to get a misuse of the initiative process by commercial interests, which, by the way, was never envisioned by Governor Hiram Johnson early in the century in California when he worked to amend the California Constitution to give people the right of initiative referendum recall. That was supposed to be citizen use, not corporate commercial use. So I think always go for the democracy facility, and then go for campaign finance reform, go for access to media, go for the reforms that would make it less likely that money prevail over information, that money prevail over over votes.
Ralph Nader, I wanted you to hear what Pat Buchanan had to say last night in his, I guess you could call it his defeat speech and his concession speech. He was speaking in Costa Mesa, California.
We're going to speak out. We're going to speak out for a living wage for the working men and women of this country. A living wage where one breadwinner can support his or her family. And we're going to speak out and say no more trade deals that sell out their jobs to the benefit of multinational corporations. No more NAFTA. No more NAFTA. You know, and we're going to go there and we're going to speak out for something else. We're going to tell them at that convention that this movement is determined to recapture and restore the lost sovereignty of the United States of America. Some World Trade Organization, given orders and directives to the country of Washington and Adams and Jefferson. We will have it written into that platform in cast iron, my friends, that never again will young Americans be sent into battle except under American officers and to fight under an American flag. And I'll tell you what else.
Council on Foreign Relations, Pat.
Council on Foreign Relations?
Close that subversive organization.
Lock and load.
Lock and load. And that is Pat Buchanan speaking in California last night. Ralph Nader, your comments on the different positions that Pat Buchanan has laid out there.
I think he's going to force the Republican Party at their convention for the first time to confront the corporate power issue, not just in the area of trade, but you'll notice he's extended it now to a living wage, which is being debated in the legislature in Minnesota. The bill which says that any corporations who receive taxpayer subsidies or corporate welfare have to pay their employees a living wage. That's going to pass the Minnesota legislature, but it it'll be vetoed by the Republican governor. But still, that's gone pretty far. Never in modern history has the Republican Party had to deal at its convention under the glare of the national media the issue of corporations having too much power, global corporations developing autocratic systems of government called NAFTA and GATT to the disadvantage of workers, consumers, and now, given the bailout of the Mexican regime by Washington, taxpayers. The real question, I think, is will Pat Buchanan withdraw that challenge in order to get his social agenda accepted by the party? I don't think he will, because he knows that his campaign has two legs, the social nativist-type agenda and the corporate power, blue-collar and increasingly white-collar worker agenda. So it's going to be a historic collision in San Diego by a party that has developed into a party of, by, and for big business, the Republican Party, and they're going to have to debate it.
Ralph Nader, you said in just beginning to talk to us here a few minutes ago on Pacifica that you would be running here in California as well as elsewhere, not on a platform that will appeal to every issue and group. One of the issues that's going to be on the ballot with you in November is the so-called California Civil Rights Initiative. Do you intend to take a position for or against that?
I'm not going to take positions for and against. I'm going to emphasize with laser beam focus the democracy agenda that goes after the excessive concentration of power and wealth in too few hands. The moment too many positions are taken, it will fracture the focus and the intensity. I'm sure other candidates in the Green Party and other Green Party volunteers in California are going to take the positions that flow logically from their own platform. But I want to focus on the democracy agenda. We have to build democracy. We have to turn it into a political issue. We have to get people talking about it, because with all the concerns people have about problems in the cities and the environment and the marketplace and health care and energy, et cetera, these are not going to be able to be dealt with unless we advance and refine the tools of our democracy.
In our political coverage here last night on election night in KPFK Los Angeles, we spoke to many community activists, Latinos and African Americans, who intend to do a lot of organizing against the so-called California Civil Rights Initiative. If you're going to build a political movement in a multi-ethnic state like California, how can you afford to ignore an issue that is at the top of the agenda of so many potential voters on your side?
Well, first of all, I've been to California 500 times. People know where I stand on these issues. I just have to focus on the democracy issue. If people in California had these tools of democracy, you wouldn't have such a proposal on the ballot. There would be a far healthier economy. The struggle between people against people in these immigration matters would not occur. There would not be a U.S. policy for supporting the Mexican oligarchy of repression and poverty, leading to a massive convulsion among the peasants in Mexico who are being dispossessed from their ejidos. So you see, I can certainly give a lot of examples, but always going back to the touchstone of giving people power, giving them information, and giving them the motivation and facility to band together. A lot of these problems would be resolved, if not anticipated, by more democratic facilities to work the will of the people in order to build the kind of economic, environmental, and social systems that would never bring us these problems which turn people against people, while the bankers and the cash indentured politicians laugh all the way to the bank.
We are going to continue this discussion after we take a break. We're talking to presidential candidate, consumer activist, and good government guru Ralph Nader. We're going to talk to him about NAFTA. We're going to talk to him about testifying yesterday before the Federal Reserve Board and what that meant, and also about his first time in 20 years on Meet the Press this past weekend. Why the media blackout? Why Why? After that, we're going to be talking with three people. We'll be talking with Linda Martin, who's head of the Draftnator for President Clearinghouse. We'll be speaking with Mike Feinstein of the Green Party in California. And we'll be speaking with Tom Leighton here in New York, who is trying to get a petition campaign going for Ralph Nader on the ballot here in New York City. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots national election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in New York, and Larry Bensky is in our studios at KPFK in Los Angeles in California, this day after the California, Nevada, and Washington state primary. Let me say, tomorrow we're going to be looking at those three states in terms of nuclear waste. We'll be looking at Yucca Mountain, Ward Valley, and we'll be looking at Hanford. That's coming up tomorrow. Right now, we have Ralph Nader, who is a presidential candidate on the line with us. Ralph, yesterday you testified before the Senate banking hearings on the reappointment of Alan Greenspan to chair the Federal Reserve Board. This also was quite historic for you to be there.
Well, it was historic for anyone. The Senate Banking Committee staff told us that never before had any witness been allowed to testify at the same time that a candidate for chairman of the board of the powerful Federal Reserve was up for confirmation. I mean, can you imagine? The whole atmosphere up there yesterday was like an autocracy coming before Congress, going through some minuet, some ritual, where Republicans and Democrats bowed and displayed obeisance to the chairman, the board of the Federal Reserve, and two other nominees, and where these three witnesses, Mr. Meyer, Mr. Greenspan, and Ms. Rivlin, talked in the most abstract economic language about the state of the economy. And everybody in that room, the senators and the witnesses, seemed to pronounce that the economy was in great shape, that it was experiencing low interest rates, low inflation, and things were just fine. I testified saying that Mr. Myers had just said that 5.5% unemployment was just about the full capacity of the economy without generating more inflation, and he was pretty happy with that. And I said, well, what about the 25% child poverty rate? I said, why don't you have that as an indicator for whether the Federal Reserve and the economy is doing so well? You see what I mean? Their indicators are all rigid. They're empirically starved. They don't reflect what really is going on with over 80% of the workers in this country, stagnant and declining wages. So I went through the privileges and immunities of the Federal Reserve Board. As many of you know, it has its own budget. It charges banks fees and gets some interest on Treasury securities from the Treasury. So it doesn't rely on Congress's appropriation process. So people in Congress, including dissenters, can't get at it through the appropriation process. And second, it has incredible secrecy. It doesn't publish the transcripts of its secret open market committees, which decide interest rates, for 5 years. So here's Alan Greenspan and his colleagues who raised interest rates, you know, a little over a year and a half ago, and that is now a major cause for the slowing of the economy, even by conventional standards. Those transcripts of those meetings by the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee won't be available until 1998-99. So the members of Congress willingly put their blinders on and do not try to break this autocratic independence and secrecy of the Federal Reserve, not to mention their very lackadaisical enforcement of all kinds of equal credit opportunity laws, home equity line laws, deceptive bank practices laws. People don't realize that they're one of the biggest consumer regulators by far in the U.S. government, and they're largely sitting on their hands. Since 1975, the Fed has not issued one standard regarding bank deceptive practices. Anybody who's used banks knows that they are working overtime to overcharge, to bill people for everything but going into the bank and scraping the carpet.
Ralph Nader, did it occur to you that perhaps the reason you were invited to testify for the first time in front of the Senate Banking Committee yesterday was due somewhat less to your great reputation as a consumer advocate and somewhat more to the fact that the very politicized head of that committee, Senator Alphonse D'Amato of New York, is Senator Bob Dole's national campaign co-chair, and that you have now become a potentially useful element in the Republican strategy to defeat Bill Clinton, for example, by taking a percentage of the votes here in California? Did you think you might perhaps be being used for political purposes by being asked to testify yesterday?
It's hard to say. I don't know. I know that Senator D'Amato, over a year and a half ago, went out of his way to invite me to comment on the bailout of the Mexican government, that whole post-NAFTA situation. But the reason why I say it's hard to say is because the criticism of the Republicans was and is pretty pretty strong. It's not like this is a hearing raking the Clinton administration over the coals. I mean, Greenspan was a appointee of Republicans.
I wanted to talk about another first, Ralph Nader, and that was this weekend when you were on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. You hadn't been on there for 20 years. And then I wanted to talk about the media blackout as well on the report that Public Citizen put out on the North American Free Trade Agreement, which may well lead people like Bob Dole in his surprising words in New Hampshire to say he was surprised that jobs and trade are the issue, considering how the corporate media has covered it. But let's start with Meet the Press.
Well, actually, it's been about 18 years since I've been on Meet the Press. Meet the Press puts people who are in politics on their program. They put candidates on their program. They put senators, representatives, governors. They don't put labor leaders, except maybe on Labor Day. But I think Tim Russert is trying to broaden out the topics and the people who come on Meet the Press. And there's little doubt that if it wasn't for this Green Party effort, that would not have occurred. I would not have gone on.
And what about the media coverage of North American Free Trade Agreement, one of the major issues that you have been campaigning on over the last 2 years and the reports you've put out since on the two-year anniversary of the passing of NAFTA?
Well, this is a very disturbing process because even the supporters of NAFTA, like Gary Huffrar, the economist here in Washington, have admitted that NAFTA, contrary to his predictions, has cost a net job loss of over 300,000 jobs. And some people will put it at 600,000. That's both vis-a-vis Canada and Mexico. And still the press and the editorials who were for NAFTA aren't recognizing this. Just yesterday in the Washington Post, James Glassman, a columnist for the Washington Post and a very pro-NAFTA, completely ignored these reports. And these reports are not opinion reports. They are extremely steeped in the data that's being pulled together by U.S. government agencies and other official sources about not only the net job loss, the horrible environmental smuggling and other conditions on the Mexican-U.S. Border, and the terrible conditions in Mexico that flowed from NAFTA's stimulation of financial speculation, which led to the peso devaluation, which led to the U.S. bailout, which has led to staggering inflation and huge additional unemployment in Mexico. And when you see a government that refuses to recognize its own data, then you can see how remote it is from any kind of democratic accountability, how important it is to have these issues become current topics in the election campaign. And since both Republican Dole and Democrat Clinton were for NAFTA, they're not going to debate it. It's going to have to be new parties, alternative parties, who begin that debate. And of course, surprisingly, the Buchanan entry into the Republican race.
Let's get back for a moment to the California ballot in November that you're going to be on here, Ralph Nader. You say you don't want to take positions on a lot of issues and want to focus on corporate power. But again, allow me to be one of the first to ask you something you're going to be asked over and over again.
Yeah.
On November, in addition to CCRI, we're going to have one and possibly two campaign finance reform measures on the ballot. We did a segment on this the other day on Democracy Now. One sponsored, as you know, by Common Cause. The other sponsored by CalPIRG, the public interest research groups locally and nationally. If one or both of those is on the ballot, can you campaign for president in California and not take a strong stand campaigning for one of those?
Well, one of the democracy agendas, of course, that I'm espousing is campaign finance reform. Unfortunately, neither of those two go as far as I would like it to go. I would like a well-promoted dues checkoff on the 1040 tax return to fund public elections and basically have a certain amount of free access on TV and radio for ballot-qualified candidates. So that is one of the concrete principles of the so-called New Democracy Agenda that is already in my platform. But you know, why I want to be so focused on this is because every time the conventional media interviews me about what I'm going to advance in this effort here, the minute they all want to talk about substantive issues, you know, the red button issues that are on the front pages of the newspaper, and the minute I try to get them on the facilities of democracy, the basic tools of power, they get their eyes glazed, and they don't want to talk about it because it's not anything they're familiar with. It's not on page one. So you have to really have a single-minded focus on the building of democracy platform, and anything else is just going to take make it impossible to get the press to focus on it at all. Yesterday at the hearing at the Federal Reserve, I pulled out this little insert that is used by the Illinois Citizen Utility Board to explain one approach to make banks accountable by requiring them to put an insert in their bank statement inviting bank customers to band together with their full-time consumer oversight watchdog and negotiating group. And you can see that that's not what they're interested in. And that's the main purpose of this effort, is to turn that around, because let me tell you, people are interested in getting power. They're losing control. They're the first to tell you they're losing or have lost control over almost everything over there affecting their lives and their families. And they want power. And that's a very legitimate quest to further in this kind of focused effort.
Ralph Nader, I wanted to talk about power politics that are going on in Washington right now, and it's also another issue you've been quite involved with, and that is the product liability debate in Congress and who is behind this whole debate. Assume people really know nothing about it, because it is very hard to gather what's going on from the corporate media.
Well, it's pretty simple. Most people will tell you that if they're ripped off, defrauded, or injured by someone's negligence or worse, that they should be able to go into court, get compensation, get refunds, and get justice against the wrongdoers, against the manufacturers of defective products like automobiles, flammable fabrics, untested pharmaceuticals for side effects, asbestos, Dalcon Shield, Pinto fuel tank, you name it. And the insurance industry and its clients, the manufacturers and other companies, basically say, look, we don't want to fight this out in the courts of law before a civil jury and a judge. We want to grease legislation in Washington and state capitals and take away these rights, make it very difficult for people to get adequate damages, to introduce evidence in court, to get a competent lawyer. And this is what's called tort reform. This is why we call it tort deform. This is an attack on a unique pillar of our democracy. This is the pride of the world. Only in America can a worker in Tyler, Texas, dying from asbestos over two decades ago, file a lawsuit that led to tearing off the mask of the asbestos cover-up, which has taken about 200,000 lives in this country since 1940. And in the 1930s, the asbestos manufacturers, as their internal memos showed, only because this lawsuit and others like it were brought to court, knew about asbestos. So we're beating them back on this. Unfortunately, President Clinton has promised a veto of the product liability bill fostered by the Republicans. It's amazing. Dole goes around the country waving the 10th Amendment in his presidential campaign, talking about states' rights, and he's leading the charge today in Washington to federalize the state common law of product liability for the first time in 200 years that anybody has tried to do this. This is the kind of hypocrisy that Bill Clinton will not expose Dole for as much as alternative candidates will be able to in the presidential campaign.
Do you intend to run anything like what we conceive of as a conventional presidential campaign, having meetings in communities all over, let us say, here in the state of California, giving speeches, getting involved in walking precincts and things like that? Or are you mostly going to let your positions stand for themselves and see how the voters respond to it? Are you going to spend a lot of shoe leather time in the state is what I'm asking you?
Yes. Well, as you know, I have spent a lot of shoe leather time in the state for 35 years. No, it's not going to be that kind of campaign. This is a no-money campaign to begin with. I'm neither accepting nor raising any money. In talking about the need for campaign finance reform, to have public funds fund public elections rather than have Exxon, General Motors, and DuPont, etc., do that, I have stated no money into this campaign, and that's the model. The second thing is that I think a lot of people in this effort want to go for quality. That is, I'd rather have 10 committed people in California working this effort than speak before 1,000 people, have them applause, and drift away. And so by not having them rely on a frenetically mobile political candidate rushing up and down, trying to raise money, trying to exhort people, it focuses on themselves. It says, I am a volunteer in this effort in California, and I have got to pull my weight with other volunteers in my community and neighborhood. In other words, the Greens know what's wrong. The people who favor the Green Party platform know what's wrong in this country. They have a general or specific idea of what's right. And this is a campaign that's got to be 90% perspiration, 10% inspiration.
Well, Ralph Nader, let me ask you this. The New York's Green Party is trying to add your name to the state's presidential election ballot, but it's going to be very difficult. New York's 33 electoral votes is second only to California's 47. They have to collect the signatures of at least 15,000 registered voters statewide between July 9th and August 20th. Of those, 100 signatures must come from at least 16 of the state's 31 congressional districts. Will you help out at all simply by coming here?
Well, I'm familiar with that New York state law. I actually wrote about it in 1958. You can see how little has changed. No, I'm not going to do that, again, for the same reasons I adduced. I want to drive this effort down into the minds and souls and energy of individuals. They've got to keep saying they have got to do it. That's the only way you build a solid foundation. This is not a PR effort. This is not an exhortation effort. This is an effort that comes from more and more people saying, you know, democracy works only if we work at it. And that's what has to be done.
Ralph, I wanted to ask you about the speed limit. President Clinton may consider you unsafe at any speed, but this is a major issue for you, and it might surprise some, I guess only those that don't know you.
Yes. You know why it's a major issue? Well, getting rid of the speed limit, which the Republicans led in doing in Congress, and Clinton signed it, even though his own Department of Transportation told him this: Mr. President, if you get rid of this federal speed limit and the states go up to 70, 75, some states no speed limit, and you got all these trucks on the highway, especially the big ones that don't have adequate brakes, they're going to be 6,500 fatalities every year and 20,000 totally permanently injured Americans and $20 billion in health care and other costs and higher auto insurance rates for everyone. He goes out of his way to dismantle a proven life-saving program which over the last 21 years or so has saved tens of thousands of American lives. And that to me is an illustration not only of his indifference to health and safety, but of his willingness to sacrifice these Americans so that he doesn't get criticized by Republican state governors who are in charge in many states on this issue. So he made an ideological curtsy, and the result is the funeral industry is going to be even more booming.
Ralph, we hope you'll stay with us. We just have to take another break. Don't worry, it is not for any corporation that brings you Pacifica. Pacifica is a corporate-free radio. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily national grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in New York. Larry Bensky is in our studios at KPFK in Los Angeles. Presidential candidate Ralph Nader is with us. Stay with us after this. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, and Larry Bensky is with us out in California. Pacifica's national affairs correspondent Ralph Nader is still with us on the telephone from Washington, D.C. What about, Ralph Nader, the two-party duopoly?
Well, it's dominating the political scene, obviously, without any grassroots activity. They're like fossils. They dominate because they're there, because no one challenges them. They compete with one another in electronic combat, largely through 30-second advertisements. And the Democrats, led by Clinton, have been moving more toward the Republican side, telling the progressives, including labor in the Democrat Party, they got nowhere to go. And that's really pretty intolerable. When the Democrats couldn't even defend the seats in Congress in 1974, and in 1994, and gave up control of Congress, that illustrates the loss of identity of the Democratic Party and how it's been spending too much time trying to mimic the Republican positions, let the Republicans set the agenda, and not raise the critical issues of corporate power vis-a-vis workers, consumers, and small taxpayers. And so how long do we allow this to go on? He tells the progressive wing, which is a huge wing, perhaps the soul of the Democratic Party, they got nowhere to go. And then he moves with Al Fromm and the Democratic Leadership Council, the right-wing corporatist part of the party, more and more toward Gingrich and Dole. I mean, the real tip-off about where Clinton is that when Dole and Gingrich propose something, let's say that has 10 points of badness about it, Clinton will jump up and propose the same thing with 8 points of badness about it. In other words, saying to the Republicans, there's no way you're going to turn my corporatist or right flank. I am going to always get close enough, but not as bad. And that's the choice before the American people, between the bad and the worst. And every 4 years, both get worse. There has to come a time when that paradigm is broken, when that two-party duopoly is ended, whether by new parties from the right, from the left, from the middle, whether by Ross Perot or other candidacies. That has to be broken, because what we have now is a mushrooming corporate party with two heads, Republican and Democrat, wearing different makeup.
Ralph Nader, I don't know if you remember this very clearly or not, but 4 years ago, you and I were part of the same large conference at the University of San Francisco called The Decline of Democracy.
Yes.
And at that conference, you were quite acerbic about what was at that time President Clinton's effort to reach out to youth culture, playing the saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show and things like that. If you look at who votes and who doesn't vote in this country, one thing that stands out is that age is really one of the great predictors of who is going to vote and who isn't going to vote, even more so than race and economic status in many areas. Only 15% of those 18 to 24 voted in 1994, for example. Is there anything that you think that you can do as a candidate or want to do this time to reach out to young people and bring them into the voting booth?
Yes, that's one of the purposes of this effort, Larry. A whole generation of young Americans are almost completely turned off politics. They see it as a dirty, no-purpose game for them. And we want to try to bring more of the young people into the political process. And one way to do it is to start with a clean slate, start with a no-money campaign at the top, start with building democracy for the 21st century, and then bring it down very concretely to their own hopes, fears, anxieties, and potential. And that could be the best result of this whole effort in future decades. If more and more people, especially those in their 20s, who usually are the foot soldiers of political movements historically, come into the political process, that would be an extremely good result of this effort.
Well, do you have a position, for example, on the continuance of AmeriCorps or how student loans should be structured in this country?
Yes, I have a lot of positions, and I'm going to start with the democracy agenda and then give examples. And some of those examples will be national service and reducing the barriers to higher education in terms of economics, all these issues. But I'm not going to start focusing on them. Because you can focus on these desired substantive issues, but then you don't have a foundation to sustain them and elaborate, because you don't have the tools of democracy, because people don't grasp to themselves the civic duties that are required to get these efforts underway.
Ralph, I wanted to ask you how you feel about being lumped together with Pat Buchanan. On the one hand, you're both anti-NAFTA, anti-GATT. On the other hand, you hear him making comments about, for example, the World Trade Organization, the Council on Foreign Relations, when someone rose up in the audience yesterday at a speech in California and raised the Council of Foreign Relations, saying it's a subversive organization. Pat Buchanan said, lock and load, lock and load. We know his views on African Americans. We know his views on South Africa, that he supported the white regime there, the apartheid regime. What do you feel about being lumped together with him?
Well, as I said on Meet the Press, it's good that Pat Buchanan finally agrees with the global trade campaign made up of labor unions, consumer groups, elderly groups, minority groups, etc. And he's done a good job in publicizing that. Obviously, his other issues are off the scale, but you know, that's the way American politics is. Sometimes it converges in unexpected ways. Who would ever dream that the insurance companies would be allies of mine years ago on auto safety? What's important is that he uses very provocative language to rev up his troops, so to speak, because he is working on a formula of 90% inspiration, by his definition, 10% perspiration. That's not going to last. That's not going to last. Once that San Diego convention is over with, the only thing left will be empty cups and trash on the floor, and he won't have a structure because he will be folded into the Republican Party, having gotten his few planks changed or modified. We're going for something different. We're going for people who say to themselves, I'm in this for the long run. I'm now going to dedicate more time every month to my civic duties. I'm going to build democracy all the way from the neighborhood to Washington, not only because it's important, but because it's fun.
Is the White House putting pressure on you to pull out?
Well, I'm receiving emissaries, you know, calls from emissaries indirectly, and from some members of Congress who are basically saying, why are you doing this? This is only going to help Dole. What they don't realize is that Perot's going to come in, he's going to take votes away from Dole. That my platform attracts both Republican and Democratic voters. In New Hampshire, when I ran on this as a non-candidate, the votes I got, 52% were Republican, 48% were Democrats. People of all political ideologies know they're losing or they've lost control over the workplace, the government, big business, the environment, the streets, their kids. And this focuses on that deeply felt feeling that they want more voice and they want more control.
It varies from state to state, but I believe in at least several states where you're thinking of trying to be on the ballot, you have to have a vice presidential running mate on the ticket with you, do you not? Who do you have in mind for that role?
I haven't even discussed it. You know, obviously, in the states where you have to have it, there has to be somebody. But that's not going to matter. It doesn't matter who's at the top of the ticket. What matters is the extent to which we focus on the new democracy agenda. That's really what matters.
Ralph
Nader.
Wait
a minute. You can't say it doesn't matter who's at the top of the ticket. Ralph Nader's at the top of the ticket.
It doesn't matter in the sense that this is not an effort for any numerical victory. The purpose of this campaign is to broaden the agenda to corporate power issues as examples of the need to get down to work and develop the facilities of democracy for these five roles of worker, taxpayer, consumer, voter, and shareholders.
Ralph, we have on the line with us some people who have been active in getting your name on petitions around the country, and we wanted to see if we can bring them in the last few minutes.
Well, Amy, you know what? I'm way behind for a next appointment because I agreed to 30 minutes, and I really am going to have to rush across town now, and I don't want to be late for that appointment.
Okay, well, we want to thank you very much for joining us, Ralph Nader, a consumer advocate and now presidential candidate. Last word to those who feel that even if you are very critical of President Clinton, that he is better than Dole and that you could possibly be threatening his presidency next November?
It's up to him. If he adopts a new democracy agenda, reaches out to the young, drops his corporate partners, he'll reduce any competition, and he'll get a lot of votes, and he'll mark the difference between him and Dole. And if he doesn't want to do that, he deserves losing votes.
Well,
thanks for being with us, Ralph.
Thank you very much for being with us. Ralph Nader speaking to us from our nation's capital in Washington, D.C. We are joined by three people right now, and we do want to talk to them all. We're joined by Mike Feinstein of the California Green Party, Linda Martin, who heads up the Draft Nader for President Clearinghouse. And in our studios in New York, we're joined by Tom Layton, who is one of the founders of the New York City Green Party. Mike Feinstein, how helpful was it to have Ralph Nader on the primary ballot yesterday?
It has been enormously helpful. The amount of inquiries for the Green Party here has gone up tenfold in the last couple of months.
And what do you feel about Ralph Nader's comment, "No, I don't agree with the whole Green Party platform. I've got my platform, they've got theirs."
No problem. We agree on the substantive portion of our platform and what he's about. And that's really what we need to do with this campaign, raise the democracy issues, the corporate issues he's talking about.
How are you going to build a large coalition on the left, especially in a state like California, where so many people are going to be interested in things like CCRI? I don't know if you heard our earlier interview, but Nader flatly refusing to take a position on it, saying it isn't an issue, basically, that he feels he needs to deal with when so many Latinos and African Americans and women, for that matter, in California are going to be actively out there working against CCRI in the fall. And here's Ralph Nader leading a dissident faction in society, doesn't even want to take a position on it.
And just for our listeners, that is the California Civil Rights Initiative.
Yeah, see, the Right. Green Party in California has come out against CCRI very strongly, and I think we can lead with it. And then we make the point that the corporate concentration of power at the top creates the zero-sum games that allows for socially divisive policies like CCRI. That's why we need Nader's message, because unless we break up that power, they're going to be able to pit poor against poor.
Tom Layton, you're here in New York City, one of the founders of the New York City Green Party. What are you planning to do? We're seeing in all the papers today on the wires that you'll try to add Ralph Nader's name to the state's presidential election ballot. Will you be able to do it if he doesn't come here?
That's probably the $64,000 question, Amy, and I think the Greens in New York State will have a lot of soul-searching to do. New York State, as you know, is perhaps the most difficult state in the union to get on the ballot, and the laws here are so restrictive. The question is whether we can rally enough troops behind Ralph Nader without his presence here or lending any support to that effort.
Do you think you can do it? Let's see. You've got, what, about a two-month period. You've got from July 9th to August 20th to get 15,000 registered voters statewide on the on these petitions.
There's no doubt we can get the signatures. Our network here in New York City in the past 2 years is in primary process, collected 10,000 signatures in general election process. As Green candidates last time, we collected 10,000 signatures. That's just downstate without a Ralph Nader, without a big name. We can do it. The question is, what the attack against us by the Democrats will be, and can we withstand the attack? Obviously, it will look great. It won't help the Democrats to be knocking Ralph Nader and the Green Party off the ballot, but they don't care about that here in New York. They'll do whatever they can to win.
Linda Martin, let's look at this countrywide. You're executive director of the Draft Nader for President Clearinghouse. What are people doing around the country? How many states are trying to get him on the ballot?
Well, that's interesting. We actually have 45 states now that have coordinators, volunteer coordinators, who are putting together separate unauthorized committees to try and raise the funds to go out and bring the people together and put Ralph Nader on the ballot in their states. And in fact, I haven't talked to Tom, but there are lots of other people in New York State who have already indicated their interest in doing this. And we're primarily doing this, as Ralph says, without money. However, we can't do it with no money at all, and that's why we established the Clearinghouse. We maintain a web page that anyone can access, and I'm happy to give you that address. And we also now have a toll-free number for across the country, and that is 1-888-NADER-96. So anybody that wants to find out how they can get involved in their state can call, and we'll get back to them with the information on their state draft Nader effort.
What is that number again?
1-888-NADER-96.
Linda Martin, you say you're doing this virtually without money. Aren't you doing it also virtually without a candidate, a guy who says he's in the race but not of the race?
Yes. And, you know, we were whining a little bit about that at first. And I think Mike will be able to relate to this. But I've actually seen the wisdom in this since the beginning, since last November. And it has forced us to get ourselves organized. It's been the most incredibly empowering element that's occurred in my lifetime in grassroots organizing. So I do thank Ralph Nader for making us do it this way.
Let me ask Mike Feinstein, are you getting more attention, the Green Party in California, than you've ever gotten before because of Ralph Nader?
It has been mind-boggling. The phone rings off the hook. We've had press from around the planet. Yesterday, we did a press briefing here with 35 journalists from Europe and Asia. I mean, the foreign press has been covering it like crazy, all the major papers. We've been struggling for years to get two or three lines, no matter how good our candidates are, no matter how good the ideas are. And let me say this. It is very refreshing to only have to be able to fight now for your ideas being right rather than having to fight to even have them being heard. What a difference. What a difference for this progressive movement.
Well, we want to thank you all very much for joining us. We want to thank Linda Martin, again, Executive Director of the Draft Nader for President Clearinghouse. Your address, your website?
The website is http://www.v.net/Nader96.
One more time.
https://www.vais.net/Nader96.
Well, that's complicated, but thank you for that. Linda Martin of the Draft Nader for President Clearinghouse, Tom Layton of New York City Greens, and, of course, Mike Feinstein of the California Greens. And Larry, thank you very much for being with us for this hour. Larry Bensky, our Pacifica National Affairs correspondent, with us from Los Angeles. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. Today's show is engineered by Bernard White and Errol Maitland in New York, Marcia Caldwell at KPFK in Los Angeles. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, a conversation with Karen Nussbaum, who recently left the Clinton Labor Department to head up a new women's division at the AFL-CIO. Also, our segment Living Democracy will look at the state of the anti-nuclear movement and anti-nuclear waste movement in the three states where primaries took place this week, California, Washington, and Nevada. I'm Amy Goodman. Join me for all that and more on tomorrow's edition of Democracy Now!